Good morning. This is Henry Harris. It is Thursday, September 26. Welcome to another installment of the weekly Emunah teleconference. Today's topic is closing the loop, creating a divine flow on Rosh Hashanah and beyond. To begin, we review the basic goal of this conversation. We are engaged in the pursuit of a mitzvah of understanding, the understanding underlying Emunah, the obligation to know and understand that there is a single power that runs this world, that there is no other power than that single power, and the simplicity of that power, and in particular, as we always say, how that shows up in our psychological experience. Just a quick sound check. Can you hear me? If you're on the call, can you hear me?
Yes.
Great. Beautiful. Okay, good. All right, so we continue. So the mitzvah, this conversation is a mitzvah conversation. It's a pursuit of a simple truth. And we're looking to understand. I was very struck by something that I reflected on this week. The Rambam begins the first line of his massive magnum opus, his main work, the Mishneh Torah, which is a summary of literally the entire the entirety of Jewish law, and he basically starts off that the first line of this 14-volume work. He says, "Yesod ha-yesodos va'amud ha-chachma, the foundation of all foundations and the pillar of all wisdom, leida she'esh sham matsui rishon, to know that there is a first existence." Now, I was struck by that notion of Yesod ha-yesodos, the foundation of all foundations. He saw fit to introduce that, all of Jewish thought and all of Jewish law and practice, with that one line. To know that the foundation of all foundations is to know that there is a first existence, i.e. a creator. And to me, that expression, the foundation of all foundations, is very striking, because what is a foundation? A foundation is what provides the possibility of stability, right? There is no building, there's no activity going forward without a solid foundation. And that's so, so striking to me when I consider what the implications of Emunah are for my psychological experience are. To the degree that I have the capacity to make sense of the entirety of my psychological experience through the lens of a simple truth, it means that I can have all kinds of psychological experiences, and those psychological experiences, as gripping and as unsettling as they might be, they fit inside of a simplicity. They fit inside of a truth that, despite my experience, my feeling experience of being unsettled or agitated, nonetheless, I have a knowing. I have a knowing that points to the simplicity and points to the stability, the foundational, the solidity, that even though my psychological experience is all over the place, up and down and unsettled, I know that the very nature of my unsettledness is part of a simple world. It's not a contradiction. The alternative is that my experience of unsettledness, my experience of unstable psychological experience, of emergencies, of distress, of all kinds of things of that nature, to the degree that I don't understand the inside-out nature and the simple truth behind all of it, it looks and feels like I'm living in an unstable world. And good luck to the person who tries to live his life and make decisions and build relationships and take step after step, one step after the other, in a world in which the foundation is constantly moving. Right? I mean, it's just such a powerful metaphor to me. Like, you imagine you're showing up to work, your job is to, you're a contractor and you're building a building, and in the course of each day's work, the foundation's shifting. I mean, can you imagine? You've got blueprints and you've got subcontractors and you've got building materials and you've got all kinds of things going on, and in the course of your building, lo and behold, at any moment, things could just meaningfully shift. And you're thinking to yourself, but what are my blueprints going to help me? I've got the best concrete, I've got the best subcontractors, I've got the best this, this, and this, and this. And behind all of it, though, is the dangerous expectation that the whole foundation is going to move. That is, to me, the essence of what the Rambam is getting at when he says the foundation of all foundations. There is no stability. There is no possibility of stability in this world when we don't have an understanding of the nature of our unstable psychological experience. We are having a varied, changing, non-static psychological experience. To the degree that we don't understand that there is a stable truth behind that, then we will be yanked around and extraordinarily unsettled by that. That is the implications of looking for and understanding this truth. And lo and behold, the Almighty set it up in such a manner. He set it up in such a manner that we will experience tremendous instability without this understanding. He is inviting us. He is calling to us. He's knocking on our door with the experience of instability by saying, look, you need something that's beyond this world. There is nothing in this world that can offer you stability. Nothing. Because all of it is being created and shaped inside of a world that is continuously moving and shifting and changing, and inside of our experience, which is shifting and moving. So we must, he's inviting us, he's knocking us, knocking on the door to invite us to come and look for a simple truth. And that's so powerful. I mean, it's just so, it's so unbelievable, the implications of this understanding. And what a blessing, that we know something about the that truth. We know something about it, and we're committed to seeking it. So, you know, as we've said on many occasions, this, the basic notion is that you're having an experience not of the world around you. You're not having an experience of the people in your life or the changing circumstances in your life. You're having an experience. You're not even having an experience of you, of what you come to consider to maybe your identity to be. I'm who I am as a person who lacks X strength or lacks Y character trait, or by virtue of my upbringing and my track record of all kinds of difficulties in this manner, I am a person who suffers from that difficulty. It's not really true. You're only experiencing this moment's revelation of the divine live feed. The Almighty is sharing with you in the same way that he's sharing with all of existence, right? There's no independent existence. All existence is continuously recreated moment to moment through this live feed, through this divine energy that's showing up and animating everything, including our psychological experience, which is why there is no piece of information, however wise the information might seem to, you know, how much, no matter how much wisdom the information points to, you and I could memorize all the summaries of this understanding. We could know it inside out in our memorization, but the information, the thought as a conscious thought, that doesn't create things. That doesn't have power. That's part of the form of this world. Everything in this world, whether it be a really delicious dessert or a fantastic vacation getaway experience or a beautiful description of a wisdom idea, all of that is basically part of the form of life. And the form of life is itself on the receiving end. It's a creation. It doesn't possess its own power. There is this kind of non, there's this divine energy that's animating all those things, which is why there are times where I can glimpse this miraculous truth and experience it insightfully in a way that my consciousness just truly opens up. But I don't know how to recreate that in the next moment, you know? I don't know how long it's going to last, and I don't know how to recreate it, and that's not really a problem. It's really not a problem. I'm just not in the business of creating internal experience. I can know and I can understand the truth about my internal experience. I can testify to the truth. I can tell the truth about what is going, what's behind my internal experience. That's amazing. That's a mitzvah too. To know that amunah is to affirm that the experience of life I'm having in this moment is coming through the gift of divine energy. Here I am. I'm standing I'm looking at my bank account balance and I'm feeling stress. It's not. It doesn't mean that I don't have something to do potentially to make an effort to, you know, make more money or something to that effect. It's not. It's not that there isn't things to do in this world, in things to learn from the circumstances of our life. But our psychological experience is not being shaped and created by any of those things. It's being shaped in this moment in a, from a force beyond me, beyond my control. And when I awaken to that, when I rule out all of the perceptions of there being things in this world that are actually shaping me, or actually shaping my experience of life, my felt experience, I open up to a certain simplicity. I open up to a tremendous freedom. I'm free. I experience a certain psychological freedom that I'm not beholden to all these things. Now, I might not, let's remember, we're looking for a truth. We're looking for a truth that is true, whether it feels liberating to us or not. As I always like to say, to me, our goal is to become, or our goal is to shift our attention from being a feeling seeker to being a truth seeker. I have permission to be in whatever feeling I find myself in for the simple reason that I don't have an alternative choice. I don't have a I'm freedom to be in that feeling because what's the alternative? I can't change that feeling in a direct sense. But what I found to be beautiful is that I can tell the truth about that feeling. And amazing thing happens when I live in the truth. When I live in the truth and I rule out the falsehoods, it's amazing how well suited I am to kind of receiving new and helpful divine understanding. It's amazing how beautiful it is to be a servant of the Creator in any given moment by telling the truth. That is a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah to acknowledge the truth. There is a constant commandment called emuna. There's a constant commandment called lo yeh lecha elohim acherim, not to give power to things other than God. Those are mitzvahs, no matter what feeling state you're in, and they position us to stand in the moment where God is actually interacting with us. They position us to greater simplicity. So that's my preamble, and I want to speak about a beautiful thought that I've shared about in the past that is in honor of Rosh Hashanah. That and then I want to share a little bit of a story where I saw the relevance of this. We know that in Rosh Hashanah God breathed the breath of life into Adam and Chava, the original human beings, the first beings with souls. They were given the breath of life on Rosh Hashanah. And insofar as we are reliving, we're experiencing Rosh Hashanah anew. That very act is being, we are being created anew on the days between Rosh Hashanah and Yom Kippur. We are being given the breath of life again. God is breathing into us the breath of life. Now, on a certain level, if you kind of look at just that dimension of it, it's kind of like it's a bit one-sided. God breathes into us the breath of life, and that's it. It comes from God to us, and that's it. But what we learn, our sages discuss the idea that God invites us on the day of Rosh Hashanah. He doesn't just invite us; He commands us to take shofar, to draw the very breath that He gave us. And in drawing that breath and then acting on His command to push that breath into the shofar for the sake of blasting the shofar, we are essentially giving that breath right back to God. That's what's going on, is that we're receiving His breath, and then we are turning around on the day that He's giving us the breath, and we're giving it right back to Him in an expression of our devotion, our expression of our acknowledgement of where our life force comes from, our expression of our recognition that we are completely and wholly beholden to and animated by that source. Now, I love this metaphor because, you know, electricians talk about the idea of what's called a circuit. A circuit is a passing of power from a source to an appliance, let's say a light bulb. Roughly speaking, there's like two types of circuits. An open circuit is where a power source connects to, a bulb, right, with a wire. So the power source goes by virtue of the bulb, from the battery to the bulb, and then stops. right? It's a single wire that connects the battery to the bulb. Now, what happens in an open circuit? Nothing. There's no flow. The power source does not, the energy from the power source does not reach the bulb because it requires a flow. It requires a closed circuit. So what is a closed circuit? A closed circuit is when the wire, after reaching from the battery to the bulb, then doubles back. It goes back from the bulb to the power source, so it creates a circuit. It creates a closed loop. And lo and behold, bingo magic, in that moment there is a continuous flow of power. And the bulb experiences the actual input of of the battery's energy, and it turns on. It becomes lit. And that is exactly what it is that we're here to do with our lives. Our lives are about receiving the divine energy, receiving the flow that God extends to us, and then recognizing that only through the power of our choice, only through our capacity to crown the Almighty our King, to declare His kingship, i.e. that we come from Him, that we are grounded in Him, that we want Him, only through our choice do we close the circuit and create an uninterrupted flow of connection, of divine energy that animates us in the fullest sense. I mean, of course, divine energy is animating us whether we close the circuit or not, right? Obviously, there is no power. The same, the table is also experiencing a divine flow. There's no other energy than that. There is no capacity for a table to be solid in its molecular structure in any manner without continuous divine energy. But there's something different and rich about, there's something wholly different about the capacity for a human being to bring a divine presence into the world. I mean, really, when we're talking about ourselves, using the metaphor of us as a light bulb, if I'm the light bulb and God is the power source, so of course God is reaching us. Of course God is reaching us at all times. But in order that I light up, in order that there's a special light that lives and expresses itself through me in the world, that takes my choice. That takes my being Mamlich HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And isn't that incredible? Isn't that unbelievable? And that's really at the root of what we're talking about is the opportunity to do that in every moment and in every felt experience of our life. Here I am in a place of resentment. Here I am in a feeling of despair. Here I am in a feeling of gratitude. Whatever it is, in the moment, in to the extent that I trace that feeling and I acknowledge that it's sourced in the single source, I loop it back to the Creator and say, wow, I'm experiencing this internal world. I'm experiencing something new and something rich, whatever the feeling is. And I acknowledge, I affirm that it is only and uniquely sourced in the divine energy behind all life. And it cannot be sourced in the sibling, the parent, the coworker, the commute, the childhood, etc. In that moment, I close a circuit. I close a circuit and I do not leave the circuit open. And in that manner, it is impossible that there will not be a new expression of divine light. There will be an animation inside of me of divine light, of divine energy that is, it's different. I will light up because of that. And that's what we're looking for. We're looking for that simple clarity, the appreciation, the being machshiv, that choice, how powerful, how rich it is. It doesn't matter. I want to be a truth seeker. I don't want to be a feeling seeker. I can feel whatever I feel. I certainly prefer to feel good feelings and nice feelings, but I don't prioritize feeling good over choosing the truth. And that, believe it or not, sets me free. It liberates me. It puts me on a path toward true stability, true foundational stability to build a life of goodness and of choices. You know, and I'll share with you a story that to me is such an illustration of this. So there's a gentleman who I've been talking with who's really struggling with a certain kind of chronic anxiety. He's got he's got financial responsibilities. Bli'ayin hara, he's a wonderful man with a beautiful family, and the pressures of the financial commitments are great, and he feels a lot of stress. And now, what's fascinating to me is that when I kind of peek below the surface of what's really challenging for him, it's the sense that here's what's going on with him. He feels that the anxious feelings are themselves a problem. It's not the anxious feelings themselves are unpleasant, but what's really troubling to him is that they seem to him an indication of like there's something really wrong, right? Like there's something really problematic and troublesome about me, about my approach to things, about my circumstances. I need to get rid of these anxious feelings because clearly I'm failing, right? Clearly the situation is really troublesome. Clearly I'm ill-equipped to do something about it because I have these anxious feelings. That, if you scratch the surface of what's going on there, it's not that he gets difficult feelings that's the problem, because he doesn't always have them. It's that he's convinced that the negative feelings need to be banished. They are an ungodly thing. They represent a disconnection from, you know, they represent a failure. They're just bad, bad, bad. And there's no God accessible to him. He's like, you know, he's really failing as a result of those anxious feelings. So I was trying to suggest to him, well, let me ask you a question. Are you open to the fact that it's not the anxious feelings of the problem, it's the fact that you feel that the anxious feelings are, you know, kind of like some kind of dangerous thing that you have to flee from, you have to get away from them. And in your process of, you know, determining them to be dangerous, and then your decision that you must rid yourself of them, you just unfortunately and innocently kind of dig in deeper to those feelings. And I share with him the following story. I had a wonderful teacher that I suspect you might have heard of by the name of Rabbi Zelig Pliskin. He's a wonderful teacher and prolific author. And he shared the following story about one of his children in growing up in Eretz Yisrael. He's originally a redhead, and his son is also a redhead. And at 6 years old, he came home from school crying one day. And his father asked him, what's the problem? He said, the children in class are teasing me. They're calling me Gingy, the Hebrew word for redhead. They're calling me Gingy, and they're making fun of me. And the kid was really distraught. So Rabbi Pliskin considered that for a moment, and he said to him, I want you to pay close attention tomorrow when you go to school to exactly how many times you're called Gingy. And when you come home, you tell me exactly how many times you're called Gingy. I'm going to pay you a shekel for every single time they call you Gingy. So of course the 6-year-old is listening to this and he's like, you know, shocked, right? Like he's gonna make a lot of money. And 6 years old, like making a lot of money, like that was a very interesting phenomenon. So he said, really? And the father said, yeah. So the next day he goes into school and he's like kind of nervous but kind of excited, and he goes up to the boys that tease him, and lo and behold, they start teasing him. Now this time though, what's funny is that the boy is not, you know, he's not getting agitated. He's got this kind of intent and even somewhat pleasurable look on his face, and he's counting with his fingers. So they're yelling Gingy and Gingy and Gingy and Gingy, and his fingers are going 1, 2, 3. And the boys who are teasing him are kind of like slightly they're perplexed, you know. They're pushing to give him get a rise out of him, but they're not. And so they decide, okay, let's try harder, you know. Let's give it another push. So Gingy, Gingy, they're pushing, and he's just continuing to count. And the teasers don't know what's going on. And at a certain point, guess what happens? They start to lose some of their excitement about teasing him with the word Gingy. So the school day ends, the boy comes home, and the rabbi asks his son, how many times? He says, 18 times. The rabbi pulls out his wallet, and he gives his 6-year-old son 18 shekels, which is like, I mean, the kid feels like he won the lottery, you know? I mean, 18 shekels is a huge sum of money, and he can't believe it's good luck. The next day he goes into school again. He walks right up to the boys who tease him, and guess what? They're not so interested in calling him Gingy. Now, what's the idea? What's the mushul in the nimshul here? Is that this boy was convinced that if you asked him, what's your problem, right? What's bottom line your problem? Before his conversation with his father, he would have said to you, it's the presence of these taunts. These taunts are the source of my problem. I can't live with them. I cannot live with them. I must get rid of them, but I can't get rid of them. And because I must get rid of them in order to be happy, and I can't get rid of them, then I'm stuck in a very unhappy state. That was the logic. Now, his father, in a very ingenious manner, helped him to realize, listen, you can live with these taunts. These taunts do not need to go anywhere in order for you to have a nice life. These taunts are totally safe. They're totally fine. They're even positive, right? They're like, you have no reason to want to banish these taunts. You don't have the power to banish them anyway, and you don't need to, right? That's all that changed, is that the boy went from feeling that these taunts were dangerous to these taunts can be there. No problem. No problem, the taunts can be there. So what I suggested to this gentleman was, your problem is not that you have anxious feelings. It's that you feel that these anxious feelings are dangerous. If you understood, if you were open to the idea that the anxious feelings represent a tremendous opportunity, right? That's part of our avodas Hashem. It's part of our serving of the Almighty, that we get to be truth seekers. We get to tell the truth about everything in this world. We get to acknowledge that the truth behind all feelings. We get to do that. That's a tremendous, like, it's not that I need to banish resentment from my life or banish sadness from, no. I get to serve in those feelings by testifying and affirming the truth about them. That is a fulfillment of extraordinary mitzvahs, like crazy accomplishments to be able to tell the truth. I'm not saying that it doesn't hurt, the feelings hurt, but you can know the truth about the feelings. And that's exactly the nimshul in the case with the boy. Like, the boy at first felt that it was an unsafe world to live in, a world with taunts. I have to get rid of them. And then he came to see, you know what, I really don't. I don't need to get rid of the taunts. The taunts can be there, and I can be there, and I can have a nice, I can have a fine life, even with the taunts going nowhere. That is 100% the truth about our experience, is that we can live with resentful feelings, we can live with depressed feelings, we can live with, they can be there. There is nothing dangerous and unsafe about them in a world in which all there is a single, simple source behind everything, where we get to see and tell the truth about those feelings, then and in the process gain tremendous accomplishment, then really, you know, there's a tremendous freedom. And that's coming back to the circuit, the closed circuit. Every time we tell the truth and acknowledge the truth about the feeling that we're living in the moment, that it can't be coming from my defective character. Because there is no such thing as defective character. It can't be coming from my childhood. It can't be coming from whatever there is of this world. It's an experiential, it's a felt experience of this moment's divine energy. Oh, but I don't like it, and if I really understood this, I should be able to change it. No. No, I'm sorry. We don't have power. It doesn't mean that we don't get insights as to how to move past a harsh feeling. We do sometimes get insights about what could be helpful. But in the moment that we find ourselves in an unpleasant feeling, without recourse to changing it, we can know that's simply the divine power, right? Like, we are not the power source. And as we get more comfortable and make peace with that, we get to stand in the wonderful role, and the very simple role of being a truth teller, a truth seeker. And that's where we close the circuit. That's where we open ourselves up to a different experience of this divine energy that flows through us, flows from God to us and back to God. It's just crazy, beautiful, light-filled experience. Okay, that is my spiel for today. Thank you so much for listening. Would someone like to offer a thought, comment, or question on what we've just been talking on?
I wanted to say that I really wish I had someone tell me what Rabbi Pliskin told his son when I was, let's say, 7 or 8 years old, because I had almost an identical situation, except it had to do with my first and last name, and kids were really making fun of both of them. And gosh, I just, now I'm thinking, like, wow, that was really the answer. But, you know, and so I'm trying to think, like, how could I do this nowadays? Because there are definitely things that I see as those taunts, like this man would see his anxious feelings as those taunts, or I may be something else that I see as triggers or as, you know, these annoying things that I can't live with. And then I was telling myself, well, should I just tell myself, like, every time this happens to me, I'm going to pay myself $1. You know, like, I'm trying to think, like, could I come up with, like, an equivalent of that, like, just to change this? Because what did Rabbi Pliskin really do? He sort of completely changed the way his son looked at those things. He didn't look at them anymore as, he showed them that they're really neutral. You can look at them as, like, life-threatening assaults, or you can look at them as, wow, I'm making money. This is awesome.
Right.
But really, everything is neutral like that. Everything is neutral, and a lot of things, unfortunately, I see that I assign to them, like, literally very threatening characteristics that make me feel very insecure. And I'm just trying to think, like, yeah, but now it's too late. Like, I'm not 5 years old or six, and is there a way to do that nowadays?
Well, look, I think it's a great question. Second, I think that any time I share this story, I run a risk of, you know, creating a potential confusion. Because if you look at the metaphor, let's be clear. Is it possible that when Rabbi Pliskin shared what he shared with his child, that the child would not have been mollified or helped by that offer?
100%.
100%, right? I mean, if a six-year-old kid is truly distraught by taunts and feels totally agitated, it might be totally irrelevant to him for whatever reason that he's going to get paid for every taunt, right? So let's remember that even in the metaphor, we're still talking about the only way this reframe experience can work is through the gift of insight. The child experienced a shift, but I'm just pointing to the logic behind it. In other words, the child, there's no technique, there's no reframe practice that, as far as I can tell, is foolproof. And, oh, if I was only 6 years old, then today I'd be able to do what that six-year-old did. You know, it's not, that's not it. Even the six-year-old might not have gotten it. It was through the gift of insight that Rabbi Pliskin had, you know, Rabbi Pliskin had Siyata Dishmaya as his father. And the child, who knows? Who knows what allowed for that? But all we know is that it was divine help, that the child was truly touched by the offer. But the logic is the logic. The logic tells us that what we see is that there was nothing about the presence of the taunts in and of themselves that constituted this child's problem. It was simply his misunderstanding that I need taunts to leave in order to have a nice life. And then he came to see through a gift that, no, he could live with the taunt. The taunts could be there and he could be there at the same time and his life could be okay. And that's all that I'm looking to point to, is that there is an underlying kind of logic truth that says, when, if it really is the case that God is the energy behind everything, then there really is nothing in this world that is inherently dangerous. You know, there's no feeling that's truly dangerous. Like, it's true in this moment, it feels dangerous. It feels like I must rid myself of this feeling. But I'm simply looking to kind of affirm and explore the kind of, you know, the that's upside down, you know, that is an outside in logic. I don't know how to feel anything other than the outside logic. Okay, but I get it. I get that even as I feel compelled, I kind of can, you know, I can do the mitzvah of Emunah. It's the mitzvah of Emunah today too. Just because it feels like I've been doing this, you know, 50 times and I'm not feeling differently doesn't mean it's not the mitzvah. You know, it is still the mitzvah of telling the truth.
So basically the answer is we don't have to be so so hung up on the fact that, oh, I have to know what to do to set myself free. It's more of Hashem will set you free if and when He deems you should be set free, and He will give you an insight, whatever shape or form that will take. And this is just one example. And our sort of our job is not to look for ways in the world of form to set ourselves free. Our job is to recognize the truth of who can set us free and where it comes from and why are we feeling the way we're feeling.
Beautiful. That's beautifully said. And also to affirm the value of this moment unto itself. Right? It's not just this moment is tolerable because it could give way to a nicer feeling.
That's what I think.
It's tolerable because it's temporary.
Yeah, that's what I think. But you're saying no. That's not it.
It seems that God in His divine wisdom sees there to be value in the moments, whatever the moment is, you know, like if He's doing something with our consciousness in a given moment, it's that moment that is worth being in. Even if the consciousness is a constricted consciousness, you know, in the same way as we've mentioned many times, the contraction, you know, of the birth process involves contractions. When a person glimpses the miraculous divine gift of birth, it just takes away the whole like complaint about the contractions, you know, like you just settle into the truth that contractions are somehow part of a divine process. And I just am so in awe of the process that I don't want to focus on valuing this above this, you know, it's all divine.
It also takes the judgment off of you because it doesn't mean anything bad about you. The fact that you're maybe not in a something that you would enjoy doesn't, because it definitely has value to Hashem, and then that means it's not a negative statement about you or like the person who finds themselves in that situation.
Yes, 100%. And as we've mentioned before, there is no question that this exile that we find ourselves in, the primary spirit of this exile is the influence of Esav. And Esav is the message of accusation. You know, any lack, anything missing in your life is such a shameful, disgusting thing. That's Esav. Esav says, I'm a made man. I was born, you know, with muscles and teeth and hair, and, you know, I'm a made man. I've got a lot, you know, and anything that is, you know, missing or any weakness is just, it's just completely disgusting. Whereas the Jewish outlook is, no, the whole possibility of purpose is only accomplished through having lack that we then acknowledge we need Hashem to help us with and then create relationship, right? Like, so it's such a crazy flip of, you know, total upside down approach to the spirit of exile that we stand in. But there's no question that we are doing beautiful work whenever we glimpse the spirit of that accusation. It can be so gripping, it can be so paralyzing, that accusation of, you know, you look at you complete and utter failure, that you have this, hide, run, go, banish yourself, because you clearly do not have the basics of life together. And in that, you know, when we glimpse and feel that kind of accusation and that, you know, whatever, then there's a part of us that's like, yeah, we got to run. But in that running, that hiding, running, we are obviously, we are stepping out of this moment, right? Any desire, any inclination to run away from a feeling or to hide from a feeling because it feels shameful is, in truth, running away or hiding from this moment. And guess what happens in this moment? Our experience of Hashem.
It's like we're running away from Hashem when we try to run
That's
away
exactly
from our
right.
own inadequacy.
That's exactly right. We're running away from the birth process. We're running away from the part that we play in His divine life, divine light coming into the world through us. That's the partnership. There's a partnership. We, as a people, we as individuals, and the whole theme of Rosh Hashanah is, you know, there's no king without a kingdom. The Almighty, so to speak, needs us to be in a relationship with Him in order that His light show up in the world. That's the whole deal. The whole deal is that we get to, you know, stay in the relationship in order that He bestow upon us this divine light. Now, the only way we can do that is to, you know, to fully stand in the relationship. And that means that there's, you know, that means understanding that there's no other power, you know, there's no kind of second domain, there's no place to run or hide. There's just here and now, and standing in that moment and standing in the truth that this is also from Hashem allows us to fully receive His light and thereby make that light in the world. That's it. You can't be, we cannot be the spouses that we're meant to be. We can't be the parents that we're meant to be. We can't be the friends or the anything without being on the receiving end of this divine light. You know, one of the themes of Yom Kippur is we do this, you know, we read in the portion in the Torah that talks about the two goats. There's two goats that are brought, two identical goats. One is brought as a, and there's a lottery that's done. We have two identical goats. We have two pieces of paper, one on which it's written to Hashem and one on which it's written to Azazel. And the Kohen puts his hand in a pouch and he pulls out, you know, whatever one, and it goes assigned to the first goat, and it's kind of a strange service, because we describe this idea of designating a goat, one to Hashem and one to something called Azazel. It seems strange, like if it's one to Hashem and it's one to something other than Hashem, it's almost as if it's acknowledging that there's, God forbid, something other than Hashem. But the truth is that if you look closely at the verses, it says the whole thing is happening before Hashem. The whole thing is happening before Hashem, that we set aside these two goats and that we designate one to Hashem directly and one is, you know, to Azazel, because Azazel represents the premise that there is something other than Hashem. that there is a Yetzer Hara, that there is some kind of an alternative experience. And part of Yom Kippur is this deep, deep affirmation that really the whole idea of Azazel, the whole idea of the spirit of insanity, this kind of spirit of insecurity that shows up in our hearts that feels quite compelling and real, all of that isn't a, it just looks like a separate domain, but the goal of Yom Kippur and the essence of kind of taking responsibility for our lives starts with the truth that we're describing, which is that whole spirit of insecurity exists in the presence of the Almighty, like it's in the context of the Almighty's mission for us. So that's where we kind of close the circuit, you know, in that way as well, that we acknowledge the perception of there being this alternative to God, i.e. Azazel, but we do the whole service, we conduct the whole service lifnei Hashem, before Hashem. That's this truth. That's this truth, the opportunity to see and affirm that there is no, you know, there is no destabilizing power. There's just the Almighty showing up in our heart in a variety of ways that we get to tell the truth about.
It's almost like a privilege that Hashem chooses that we should have a lack, because He wants us to come to Him. Just like for the snake, He created an environment where the snake would never have a lack, and the Almighty was sort of saying, I don't want you coming to me, so you'll always have food. Yes. And I just constantly find myself subconsciously looking for an environment where I don't have lacks. And then I'm like, wait, but that's not what Hashem wanted. You really want me to come to Him for help. You know, and Esav is like trying to trick me into thinking, no, you'll really be good if you don't have a lack, if you figure it out yourself.
Right. Right. Yeah. And you know what? We get to revisit. Say again?
I'm sorry. So it's very tricky.
It is. And you know what? We see things and we gain understanding. But then, you know, we can't hoard it. We can't kind of get it once and then it's ours. Like, there's a reason why these are constant commandments. There's a reason why they're constant in the sense that, now what's interesting is that in the metaphor of that boy, you know, what happens when we gain an insight, when we see ourselves that the presence of certain unpleasant feelings or hard feelings, or, you know, when we gain an insight that the very presence of those things are not a problem, lo and behold, guess what? The Yetzer is like, well, it's not working, you know? Like, I'm not getting the rise, the agitation out of him that I thought I would get. Okay, so it's time to move on to a new agitation, right? And that's really what growth is. Growth is you're living in a certain experience where something feels threatening to you. You gain insight about the fact that that is not the truth. And then, lo and behold, the Yetzer has to come up with some source of agitation. He's like, there's no point in yelling Gingy at the boy anymore, because the yelling Gingy is not doing anything. Okay, so let's let go of yelling Gingy, and now let's look for some new place where there's not yet clarity about this truth, and we'll start poking at that. That's what growth is. That's how our growth goes. We see something new that allows us to acknowledge the oneness of God in a certain place of life. And then what comes into view is like a new horizon where there's now a new level of, there's like a new playing field, you know. Before I got clear about the whole Gingy thing, it wasn't even on my radar to be concerned. I don't know, I'm just using the metaphor of the six-year-old boy, like, I wasn't even aware of the boy wasn't even aware of being concerned about his backpack being not the same backpack as other boys, because he was so bothered by the Gingy thing. Then, lo and behold, he moves past the Gingy thing, and now he notices something that was not even a perceived concern for him before. Oh, he doesn't have the same backpack as others. I don't know, that's just an example. Like in my own life, let's say, you know, right now, I don't know, I have a certain certain level of commitment to Torah learning that I feel that my struggle exists in a certain, you know, with a certain type of struggle. Way beyond that level of struggle doesn't even, like, you know, to consider whether I could emulate, you know, some incredible tzaddik who learns, you know, throughout the day and night, that's not even on my radar. Like, I'm not even feeling a place of struggle or concern there because it's just so far beyond me. But as I see new things, that my struggles get softer because I have more room for those unpleasantness in my life, then those uncertainties and those kind of agitations start to go away, they dissolve, and then a new playing field opens up where it looks to me like, hey, why am I not able to accomplish X? And that whole, why can't I accomplish X, was completely not in my view before, and now it is. That's how growth works. That's how we gain, you know, new place. And it's not a linear kind of complete thing, like, you know, two steps forward, two steps back, a step forward, two steps back, three steps forward, a step back. Our consciousness is kind of, you know, but we're sticking with these Emuna truths. And that's what is, as far as I can tell, the surest, most reliable underpinning of growth. Well, I'm noticing the time, and I see that we're basically at the end of our hour. I want to take a moment to wish you all a chsiva v'chasima tova, to be signed and written and sealed in the Book of Life for a good, sweet year. Thank you so much for taking the time to partake of our conversation, and that's it.
Thank you so much.